Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the Quarantine Break Podcast. How are you doing? I hope you're all keeping well and safe. We have reached episode 5 and today we have the spectacular Tracy Ann Oberman on the show. I've spent a large portion of lockdown with her, from her wonderful Auntie Val in Friday Night Dinner, to Rebecca in Afterlife, to Helen Chalmers in Code 404. She has been involved in some of the very best TV of the year, and it just so happens it has all come at once. This is a really interesting conversation, and it goes to some really fascinating places. She's such a warm and interesting person. I think you'll really, really like this episode. Take a listen, and I'll be back at the end. Tracy Ann, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, I know, in my busy social schedule, I've had to cancel lunches and dinners, and delighted to be here. Thank you for asking me.
Because we live in a working from home world now, they've decided to retarmac the street outside my house. So if you hear anything loud and obnoxious throughout this conversation, only a fraction of it will be coming from me.
It's not them digging up the bodies in your backyard.
Hopefully not. We've lived here a few years, so I'm really, really hoping it's not that.
That's good that they're resuming some work somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. I should be grateful for that. But at the moment, all I'm thinking, will I suddenly hear builder noises throughout this? But hopefully we'll be fine.
I live for the day where I will hear builder noises. Life outside these four walls would be amazing.
But how have you been keeping? Have you and your family been keeping well?
Yes. I mean, it's a weird dystopian time. My husband had a vague version of the COVID where he lost his sense of taste and smell. Yeah. And my daughter had a really bad cold. And then weirdly, we were offered via a friend this sort of the prick test where they take some blood out of your finger.
Yeah, yeah.
So both he and my daughter tested for the antibodies, which meant that they had COVID. But weirdly, I had tested negative. So it just goes to prove that you can live with two people with COVID and not get it so far. So I don't know.
That is strange. My wife has also had it, and I've not had the test to see if I've had it. I think I was fine, but I have no idea. As you say, you can live with someone and still not get it. That's bizarre.
Do you have low or high blood pressure? This is my new theory.
Oh, I'm not sure. I assume I have high blood pressure just because I'm that kind of person, but
then you should technically be. Well, no, I just think, you know what's so frightening about this is that clearly nobody knows anything about anything.
Yeah.
So people are, everybody, even the science, is just fumbling around in the dark trying to find some answer. And I've spent my life reading dystopian novels and sci-fi. Mm. I've read every dystopian, contagion, sci-fi novel and film ever. It's been my obsession. So I should have been totally prepared for this moment. And even I was shocked at my own sense of panic and disbelief.
Right at the start of this, I think it was ITV that was showing Pandemic again, because it's meant to be quite an accurate film, I think.
Yeah, I haven't, it is quite accurate, but I think the problem is, I started watching it, and then I thought, again, I thought I'm not going to watch it because there's an ending to that film. And at the moment, there is no ending in sight to this.
Yeah.
Nobody knows how this is going to end. And when you're actually in the eye of a kind of pandemic, global catastrophe storm, economically, health-wise and everything, it's the uncertainty that is, I think, the killer, because we don't know, you know, apart from economically the impact on the world and the sort of world we're going to go back to, it's just on a need to know basis, isn't it? Which they don't show you in the books. When's Tom Cruise coming in?
And his mad, crazy run. I love that. We need Tom, don't we?
A version of Tom. A version of Tom.
For new listeners, the idea of this podcast is hopefully about taking a small tea break from the outside world, a world where I implore you all to ignore unverified sources of information such as Facebook or the President of the United States. But before we move on, it's a tea break. So Tracy Ann, how do you take your tea?
Really strong, super strong, sometimes two tea bags, like the strongest builder's tea you can imagine. There's a poster knocking around, isn't there, of different colours of tea that you can get. So you can just say, I'll have a number one or a number three. Well, mine was right up there. I think it was a 7 or an 8. No, probably an 8 or a 9, like super strong.
Do you leave the bag in?
Sometimes I leave 2 in. So
that's
bad
good.
Your adrenals, I know.
You must be wired all the time.
Yeah, maybe that's why I'm an insomniac. I haven't put it together yet. No, I do. And I was told it's really bad to do that. But I really like it strong. And sometimes, you know, a Yorkshire tea bag doesn't get the strength that you want it to have.
It has been a mad old time for everyone at the moment. Each week, I think, feels a bit different. I feel different than how I was last week. How have you been dealing with lockdown?
Well, I mean, you know, this is a weird, such a weird time, because in literally 24 hours, everything changed. So I was about to head off. I had my whole year of work planned out with and sorted the family out. I was on my way to Manchester to start filming this big BBC One drama. That was going straight into doing a Sky comedy. Then I was going to start on this big theatre project, The Merchant of Venice. So my whole year had been mapped out. And within that, school holidays and family and kids and everything. And within 24 hours, everything just went, you know, it didn't just go so you could mourn it. It was just like, we're going to put it on hold until the foreseeable future. So just not knowing. And then, so that's been hard. My daughter's school shut. She was very upset. She was the lead in the school play. She had exams coming. So, you know, that's all hard. And, you know, my husband runs this big kind of DJ music production thing globally, and they had to suddenly move. I'm burbling on, but, you know, life changed in an instant.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I know a lot of people who have lost people. Last week alone, I had 5-6 friends who lost a parent. Friends who've lost siblings. So it's really real around here. We're right near the hospital, and all you hear is hospitals, ambulances 24 hours a day. So it is really real. And living in the heart of sort of North London it suddenly made me listen to friends of mine that have moved out, that in the past I thought, oh, who wouldn't want to live in London? And now I'm thinking, God, I wish I lived out in the country. That hasn't changed at all. Having a lovely old time going for 2-hour walks. So yeah, it impacted and it bit hard. And it's been a series of, you know, they say the 5 stages of grief is sort of denial, grief, anger, all of it, and then finally acceptance. And I don't think I've got to acceptance yet, but I'm in some sort of level of it.
Definitely. I think at the moment I'm personally trying to find little moments of joy, I think, in the small things. And actually, I have to say, you posted a video of your dog Scruffy and Max waiting outside the butcher's, I think, for the first time in 10 weeks.
Yeah.
It's had about 10,000 views. 8,000 of them were likely me.
Oh, what are they really? I never even understand the views. Yeah, oh, those dogs were so excited. Oh, my God. And the butcher's is pretty empty. And they were just, oh, my, they were just so happy, and then got no treats from the butcher. But they loved it. I have to say, though, I've used my time creatively very, it actually, at the beginning, I had a sort of fear of, fuck, what happens now?
Yeah.
And then I went into, oh, I get to do all the things that I've never had time to do. And so we all spent loads of time together, me, the family, the dogs, the daughter. We were all like, oh, we like each other so much. This is great. Then I started cooking, like proper cooking. It was like, oh, I can feed my family as well. I can go back on MasterChef. I might, oh, wow, this is great. I was getting John Turode and Lisa to send over their daily recipes that they've got on Instagram. Amazing. I really was acing it. I was cleaning. I had turned into the domestic goddess. And then after like 2 weeks of that, it was, my daughter was like, leave me alone, and locked herself in the room. Husband locked himself where he's working. Kind of lost the art of cooking. So then I moved on to, I've been writing a radio. I had a commission from Radio 4 to write a radio play. So I wrote that. I've done the second draft of that. I'm doing some filming with this dumb breeding thing. I've finally understood Instagram and the point of it. It's all good-ish.
It's strange because I think as well, I'm getting a new level of FOMO at the moment.
Are you?
Well, in the past, it would always be I'd go on social media and I'd see people in the pub or on nights out that I wasn't on, and I'd be like, oh, I want to be doing that. Now I'm seeing, you know, people streaming the National Theatre or learning how to make pasta, or you know, having drinks on Zoom. I'm always getting a new level of FOMO now.
Yeah, well, that I early doors, I tweeted about this, or I did a little video, because I was getting a lot of people saying to, you know, sort of saying, oh, my mental health, and I'm finding it very stressful. And I put out a thing around the time when I was doing nothing that said, we have one job here, and that is stay alive. You know, you don't have to pressurize yourself. This time is not about learning a new language, learning how to cook, doing anything. All you have to do is take it one day at a time and stay alive, and don't put yourself under any pressure to compare yourself to anybody who's doing amazing things. We do it in our own way. Having said all that, I just ended up doing everything. But I did have a few weeks, but because I wanted to. And I've never had less of a FOMO, because I think nobody can go anywhere. Nobody can do anything, really. Everything is about us all just surviving, and we're all in it together. So don't have FOMO. There's nothing to FOMO about. You're doing a podcast. I FOMO you.
The one thing I have not given a go, because I just cannot do it, is TikTok. I downloaded it. I was on there for 5 minutes and just deleted it. I'm quite happy for the Judi Dench ones just to filter onto Twitter, and that's how I'll see them.
I don't even, my daughter is doing her TikTok master's degree. I mean, she's really, you know, that's all the 13-year-olds are doing now. She might even get a PhD or a doctorate in TikTok. That's what they're I can't even understand it. She made me do a dance after Friday night dinner went out the other day. I don't get it. But the ones I do like that I've seen are the drunk Trumps.
They're amazing.
Yeah, brilliant, you know, using his actual, have you seen the one in the club?
Yes, that's been so good.
It's the medicine one, you know, the germ, and it ends, it's so good.
That's why I'm quite happy for them just to filter onto other social media platforms. I'll pick it up from there.
We don't need to do it. It's for the young people and the old people.
But it's interesting what you say about creativity. A lot of the people I've spoken to on the podcast, Sarah Phelps, Robert Webb, these are creative people, and they are finding it tough. And yet we've seen lockdown versions of Parks and Rec. Stafflet's Flats is doing a short. Your dear Matt Berry is doing some lovely Toast of London shorts.
Well, that's the thing with Matt. Thank God for Matt, because Berry, right at the beginning, Matt said to me, buy yourself a mic and set up a home studio. And I said, oh, my, I'm so untechnical. And he went, I'll talk you through it. So between him and my husband, we got all the stuff that I needed. And thank God I did, because he was the first one that said, right, we're going to do these Mrs. Purchase toast pods, which are very funny. And then because of him, I've been able to do documentaries. I've been able to do voiceovers. If you need me, contact me at Calypso Voices. so that's been very good. And he really helped on that. But yeah, Matt's been brilliant at those. People love his Toast of London stuff.
So good. But you were actually amongst the first wave of creativity during lockdown with Dumb Breeding. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and how that came to life?
Yeah, that was incredible, because Julie had written this very funny comedy about five lifelong friends who were now in their 40s and 50s. And, you know, their kids had grown up, they'd been through birth deaths and marriages together, body changes together, all of it. And I think it was in with a big production company. And in the end, it was, I got the scripts and she said, we're going to try and shoot this in lockdown. and be at the cutting edge of that, but it's not about lockdown. So they did, the scripts were fantastic. The characters were fantastic. I said yes, not totally understanding how we were going to do it, but they delivered these cameras and lights. I mean, you can see in my room there were sort of, well, you can't, but there are lights and sound things everywhere.
Yeah.
And then we now film these weekly episodes. There's 12 10-minute episodes coming out. We film them in our own houses with the people around, whoever's around to help. Mainly I'm doing it on my own. I feel like Orson Welles. And then we upload it, all gets edited and graded, and it's going out. And how, for me, the thrill of that is that, you know, this is not an industry known for its kindness towards women after the age of sort of 30, 35.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of the most sexiest, most amazing women I know, gorgeous, are getting scripts for the parts of grandmothers opposite men who are 5 years younger than them. So here was a real cutting edge script with five sexy, but happening, exciting, vibrant women all leading this show who were at the cutting edge of technology, of getting it out there, about a demographic that normally wouldn't get seen.
Yeah, and it must be very liberating as well, because TV projects aren't quick affairs, are they? And to shoot something and put it out there immediately, it must be quite thrilling.
What's so nice is it's really, look, people are desperate for new content. It's really captured the imagination. She's got an incredible team on it. You know, there's Hamza Nowthwaite, Angela Griffin, Julie Graham's written it and stars in it, Denise Welsh, Alison Newman. There's some really great people attached. And it's sort of captured the imagination. So I think people are excited to see something that is upbeat, that's funny, that's about women, it shows their lives, written by a woman. Yeah, it feels very exciting to be at the first wave of that.
And what's it like as an actor to take on this new challenge? Is it very different from previous stuff that you've done?
Well, the last thing I was laughing because Code 404 is going out at the moment, and I'm in that. Yeah. I was doing some publicity for that, and I was watching a bit of it with Stephen and Danny, Stephen Graham and Danny Mays are in it. They're brilliant. And I was laughing about the comparison of the days of being on that with all the high-tech wizardry, green screens and, you know, the 120 whatever crew, to suddenly being in my room, having to light myself and direct myself and work out my shots. And it made me have a complete respect for every single person, not least the person that makes the sandwiches and the tea.
Yeah,
I didn't even get my own lunch break, but I'm learning a lot of new skills.
As we're talking about what we've been watching, it seems a good time to talk about what you've been watching recently.
Oh God, what haven't I been watching? Oh, so I've just done the whole of Taboo.
Oh,
loved it. I missed it the first time round, but I remember Stephen talking about it. I think he was talking about it, and a lot of the crew who'd been on Taboo were on Code 404, and they were saying, you'd love it. I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
It sort of slipped under the radar, I think, first time around, certainly for a lot of people. I don't think it got massive views, but it's such a good show. It's really, really good.
Have you seen it?
Yeah, yeah.
I loved it. I mean, God, what a privilege to see Tom Hardy on screen. Mm. And that cast, it was mind-blowing. Everybody was just stupendous. And the accuracy, the Dickensian vibe, I can't speak highly enough about it. And then I was very disappointed because I love Alex Garland, and I love sci-fi, and I love all of that AI stuff. And so I did Devs, and I found that really hard going.
See, I was mildly obsessed with Devs. It was one of those shows that I could watch one episode, but then I would need a week off just to think about it.
We were doing two at a time, and I love the time. I love the fact that Alex Garland felt that he wanted those hours to use to be able to spread out. And I found it challenging, and I was annoyed at myself that I found it challenging, and I was surprised that I found it challenging. But I really found it challenging.
And I saw that you, like the rest of the world, have been watching Tiger King.
Yeah. Very upsetting.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
And more upsetting than the series is the kind of affection that people have for those awful fucking men.
Yeah.
You know, all these sort of like, that was a dark program. That was as dark a documentary for me as Capturing the Freemans. Mm. It was dark. I mean, these were like the lowest edge of humanity, basically abusing animals in order to sexually groom young people, bring them in, ply them up with drugs and control them. And then, oh, it was just horrible. Horrible and yet fascinating.
And now Nicolas Cage, I think, is going to play Joe Exotic, which is going to quite strange.
I mean, you know, just do the... To me, it's just the Fred and Rosemary West, you know, with Julia Roberts. I mean, why would you have to dramatise a story that was already so dramatic and odd and weird? No, I know, I don't. I get the Tiger King horror and jaw drop. I don't get the love.
Yeah.
I don't. These are not fun characters. This is not a funny show. It's a really dark show about horrible, horrible people.
And I think I saw that you also blitzed through The Nest as well, which was also absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, loved it. Really loved it. Well, he's just amazing.
Yeah. And
I thought the writing of that was really great. That was a nice, slow build.
Yeah, yeah.
And I like dramas that will take their time and really like proper grown-up, intelligent stories. It was good, really good. And what else have I been watching? Well, everything I've been in, which seems to be lots at the moment. So I did Afterlife, which I loved, and I've loved Code 4. I really enjoyed watching Code 404. This series of Friday Night Dinner was fun.
Have you been dipping into any of the Doctor Who watch-alongs? That's been a lot of fun. They've been organised by Doctor Who magazine's Emily Cook.
Oh, yeah, I took part in one with Russell rang me and said, yeah, would I do a little video as Yvonne Hartman?
Amazing.
I kept all the old costumes and necklaces and even my Yvonne Hartman badge from those episodes. So I dressed up as Yvonne and said a thank you. And so I saw that one, and I haven't had a chance to dip into the others, but I will.
I honestly think your line about doing your duty for Queen and Country should be the official slogan for lockdown.
Oh my God. If I say to Russell, if Yvonne had been in charge of all of this, none of this shit show would have happened from Brexit onwards. I mean, she should have just been running it all. She is the Prime Minister, President we needed at this time.
And what about relaxing during these times? I keep asking people about meditation apps, but nobody is using them at the moment.
Well, no. I mean, no.
Anything like Joe Wicks PE or any of that sort of stuff?
No. My husband has got a Peloton. We got a Peloton early because we both got very bad backs. And so we've been paying off a Peloton sort of monthly, and that's been good. So we've been Pelotoning. And also we have a doggy, so we were allowed out. So we used to walk the dog, you know, walk the dog every day near here in the park. So that's been nice. That's been my meditation. And I've been listening to a lot of podcasts, which I've never had a chance to do before.
Yeah.
Because you can cook and listen or walk and I think that is. I found the podcast love really surprising, because I think I've never really had the time to do them.
I often use this part of the podcast to talk about a guest show that has just been on TV or a book that's just been released. But I don't know where to start with you. You've just appeared in three of the biggest shows of the year: Afterlife, Friday Night Dinner, and Code 404. I mean, what an incredible time.
It's so weird. You know, you film all these things spread out, and then they all come out at once, which is very odd. And I know I keep getting messages from people going, I mean, you know, I'm not, because it just, and they're so different. So people going, are you in everything? Are you in everything at the moment? You know, so yeah, it's been good. Very lucky that they all came out at the same time, because people have had to watch them because they've had nowhere to go.
I mean, we'll start with Friday Night Dinner, because the reception to this series has been incredible, hasn't it?
Yeah, so six series. And I think when it went on Netflix, it really started to impact. I think it was a bit of a kind of hidden gem. It was very highly rated on four, but it didn't make the impact like it did on Netflix. And then this last series has just gone, it's become like, cult, sort of a cult level of adoration for it.
Yeah, and record ratings. It's just done so incredibly well, and the reviews have been just off the chart. I mean, it's such a wonderful series. It must be such a joy to return to a character like Auntie Vale. She's, I guess, unique is how we would call her.
So, you know, it's so funny because Auntie Belle came in that first series just for the one episode, the dress, and then Robert loved her and then he brought her back and he's brought her back. She's become like a real, like, little, you know, if you've got this incredible ingredients and recipes, she's like the little flavouring that comes in a few times during the series. But people just love her. And she's like that, you know, your auntie that's just over the top. And in that world of Friday Night Dinner, I think she adds a level of hysteria that is people seem to love her. I like it. And what's nice about that series is we've been doing it for such a long time that when you come back into the house, it is like slipping on a very well-worn coat. And those actors are at the top of their game, so beautiful.
I do a bit of research, as you'd expect before these conversations. and it led me to this story on The Sun, and it started with this first paragraph, and I don't know why, but it made me laugh a lot. Friday Night Dinner's Auntie Val has reflected on the time she got stuck in a cage and the steamy plots involving Colin the sex robot. Firstly, it sounds like Auntie Val is a real person and they've mistaked it for a documentary. If you'd never seen the show, you would come in expecting a very different programme.
It's a very, very indicative sign of the times that I wouldn't normally be somebody that The Sun would pick up on for a story. So either there is a very slow news day, there's a very slow entertainment news day, so any content is worth filling. And also that there's the Sun skewering of that particular storyline into making it into a steamy and salacious little, very funny.
I mean, what an episode that was. That must have been a joy to film.
It really was. And, you know, very sadly, my beloved stepdad, I mean, this is a bit sad, but it was a difficult time because I'd just come out of this play very long. I think I was still doing this really full-on play and my stepdad was dying and I didn't know when it was going to. So it was like that mixture of sort of heightened comedy and expecting the call any minute. So everybody was very sweet on set, but it was a difficult shoot because I didn't know if I had to run off. But we actually got through that episode, which was pretty amazing. And, you know, just the filling up Martin's bowl, Paul's bowl with that rice pudding and Jim and it was all just hysterical, you know, having Paul Ritter smashing the top of that cage with no top on and then getting the saw out. I've never laughed so much. It was amazing.
When you got the script for that episode whether the stage direction just said Auntie Val gets into cage, well, I mean, does that translate on paper or is that something you have to see on the day?
Well, Robert rung me and said, look, I'm writing this episode that is going to be centered around Auntie Val, and I just want to say one word. And so he said, I'm going to give you one sentence that will sum it up. I'm in a cage. I'm in a cage. And I wet myself and I said, just don't tell me anymore. Let me read the script. And it was, I'm in a cage. It was, it translated. Because that's the thing. It doesn't matter how ridiculous that, you know, really good sitcoms are all character driven. So you buy into those characters. You believe anything in the world, in their world that happens, you buy into because you believe the characters, you believe the world they've set up. So in a normal family, that would be ridiculous. But in the Goodman family, it kind of works.
How do you think the Goodmans would be dealing with lockdown?
Oh my God, Martin would be 6 feet under, I would imagine. I don't know, terrible, terrible.
I like to think that Adam and Johnny would have been forced to move in for the duration.
Definitely, 100%. The Bambinos would be there with their mum and dad. I would have thought Jim would have managed to finagle his way into the house as well, so yeah. They would have all been in there. With Milson and the puppies.
They'd be working from home. They'd be slowly being driven insane.
They'd eat well, though.
Yeah.
Actually, maybe Val would have had to move in with them as well, because obviously she's now, she's not with Larry anymore. Oh, my God, can you imagine? They'd all be in the house.
I mean, Robert, if you are listening, Series 7 ideas already. I mean, nothing is certain at the moment, but do you think Friday Night Dinner will return?
All I know is Robert is brilliant. I mean, to write 6 series worth of episodes on your own, never to have farmed them out to anybody, he's such an auteur. I don't know. I mean, you know what? I watched that last episode and a little tear came to the eye and it was like, oh, wonder what will happen. And then I got so many messages on socials and from, you know, texts and everything from people who were devastated, proper crying, devastated, like they'd lost a family that they loved. I don't know. I'd like to think it might go again, but I can't say. I mean, Robert has specifically said nobody's to comment on it because nobody knows. So there we go. Never say never, I always say.
And from crying at that final episode of Friday Night Dinner, Afterlife then. I mean, Tracy Ann, why would Ricky release something like that into the world at the moment? If I'm looking pale and pasty at the moment, it's because I'm cried out at the moment through fault of shows that you've been in.
Oh, I know. Ricky's baby has really affected people. That first series was extraordinary because I don't think people knew that Ricky could do that. I mean, it just broke your heart. Yeah. It was my mum, who, as I said, who's recently been widowed and has lost a lot of friends through COVID, rang me the other day and said, she didn't even know I was in it, but she said, I've been watching this Ricky Gervais show called Afterlife, and it's so brilliant. She said, has he lost somebody? I said, did he lose his wife? I said, I know he hasn't. He's still with Jane. She said, but it's so truthful and honest. And it's the first time I've had a really good cry and laugh and feel like I managed to release something. And I think Ricky's just tapped into something really quite incredible here. Would you agree?
Yeah, it's such a beautifully made programme. I mean, it does tap into, I think, a level of grief that you don't really see so much on TV. It's either so over the top or ridiculous. It's just got so many levels of nuance, and it's just a really, really beautifully made program.
Yeah, he's taken the time to show a man who really is grieving. And I mean, I don't want to speak out of turn, but, you know, Ricky and his partner Jane have been together for a long, long time, and she's just the most wonderful woman. And I remember going to the screening of the first series, and I said to her, wow, for me, this is a love letter to you. And that makes me cry even more, because it's like when you've been with somebody for so long and you've loved them for so long and their relationship is very strong, I suppose that when you've met your soulmate, the thought of losing them, how do you continue? But the thing also about Ricky is that the comedy is so brutal as well, and it walks that line between tragedy and comedy. You know, it sort of punches you in the stomach one minute and then punches you with a really dark humour.
You made such a memorable appearance as well in that first series of that incredible date.
I was so chuffed. I mean, I got this script. I didn't even know. I just said, I got this message saying, you know, Ricky would like you to play this part. Didn't know anything about the series. Read the scene, thought it was funny. Didn't even understand the series. Never got the full scripts. Did that. We had a lovely day up in Hampstead filming. It was the first day of the first series on the shoot. So Ricky was, you know, it was brilliant. We'd had a lovely day. La la, bye bye. Never thought any more about it. Then I got invited to the screening and I was like, wow, Ricky, this is it's amazing. Never thought any more about it. Then the series went out and people loved it. Then the scene appeared and I got so much feedback from this one scene. It was just unbelievable. People were like saying, oh, it was so funny. And then really sweetly, Ricky kind of got me back in for the next series. Yeah. But we filmed a lot more. We filmed like 4 days. But because the episodes are only 20 minutes long, he had to cut a lot out. But I was very honoured to be in it.
I mean, considering how poorly that first date went, it must have been a surprise that you were in series two.
I think we thought it would be nice to redeem that character, Rebecca, just to sort of show her that she wasn't that bad. And that gave him a chance to sort of forgive her. And it sort of showed him that even the most ghastly people have their own stories in life. I don't know. But I was just really blessed to be asked.
And moving on to Code 404, which again is a very different gear shift, but it's so much fun. I was watching the blooper reel last night and it looks like you guys never stopped laughing on set.
That was a joy. I mean, imagine Stephen Graham, fresh off The Irishman and everything else, who I've long admired, and Danny Mays, who, again, I think they're like two of our finest, on this show that was this ridiculous comedy about a cop who's brought back from the dead, like a crap RoboCop, but played with all the seriousness of a sort of Line of Duty, but with this very broad comedy as well. It was incredible. I mean, proper funny, because the straighter you play things, the funnier they are. And Steve and Danny, I had all my scenes with them. And again, I was in very early on. Normally when you're in early on in a shoot, you get the best of people because they're not knackered and tired. But we, yeah, didn't stop laughing. It was hysterical.
As you say, I think that is one of the keys to its success. It is played so straight. It's like Naked Gun, when everything is so straight. No one's like glancing at the camera or giving that wink. It's a cop drama, but it's still very funny.
Yeah, and it's a really good, even if you just took it as a thriller, it's a good cop thriller, but then you've got this really funny physical comedy. I've never seen anything that walks the fine line between drama and comedy so lightly as that. And the element of Stephen and Danny is it just gives it something that takes it to another level, I think.
And I know Stephen can do comedy, but I was genuinely shocked of his lightness of touch as well in that series.
Yeah, I mean, incredible. I used to say to the producers and the directors that it was like watching a masterclass, because they're properly brilliant acting. I mean, they are properly brilliant actors. So I would watch them in anything, and then to be on a set with them and watch them do that gear shift. And I know that Stephen was quite like early on was sort of like, I don't do comedy, you know, I don't know how I feel about this, but it just worked. You know, this is a guy from Taboo and the Irish, you know, everything we've seen him in, and the two of them from Line of Duty. And then to be in this, there was just an added piquancy to the humour.
And one future project I need to speak about before I let you go, The Boys from Russell T Davis. I saw a clip at a Channel 4 event and it looks incredible. Can you tell us anything about it?
That series is, I think it's, you know, if Schindler's List was Spielberg's sort of reason to be put on this earth, I love Russell's writing, but this is something else. This was ripped out of his heart. This is the most beautiful storytelling about a really horrendous and I think sometimes forgotten period of what it was like to have AIDS during the 80s and 90s. It's heartbreaking and funny and brilliant and all the signature things we know of Russell, but it's something else. I can't even put it into words. The scripts are unbelievable.
I think every time Russell has done interviews over the years, he's always talked about a series that he wanted to write one day, and it feels very much like this was that series.
100%. He's had many fine moments, but I think this is his legacy to leave that story, because as he said, so many young men and women, but mainly young men, died of this plague that nobody understood, that nobody was that interested in, that there was so much misinformation, and they were very cruel deaths. And these were all people that he knew, you know, this was his life. You know, you came down to London, you were young, you were out, you were suddenly having a life that was so exciting, and then you were treated like a pariah, and it was very cruel. And because people were so frightened of it and didn't understand it, you know, I had a friend who was gay and had come out. And I remember him around the time of AIDS had gone to stay with another friend's family. And when he left, the parents burnt the sheets, buried the crockery. I mean, you know, people were treated like absolute pariahs, and their deaths were often horrible. And their parents saw something that was terrible. And as Russell said, those parents are dying off, and people forget what it was like to be gay, what it was like to be gay during a terrifying time with HIV, and how horrible people could be about it. It's a bit heavy for a coffee break, isn't it?
It sounds amazing. It's going to be an incredible drama. I know it was still filming earlier this year. What was all the filming completed before everything shut down?
Yeah, no, they got that in, definitely. So that was quite a long shoot. I think it was a 3-month shoot. And I mean, I'm just in 3 or 4 of the episodes, but that core cast are incredible, because it's about a group of friends that live in this, the Pink Palace, and Ollie from years and years is head. Wow. I mean, wow.
That's his first acting role as well, I think.
No, really. I worked with him when he was a child. He reminded me. We did a film together called Summerhill about a school called Summerhill that was... And I'd forgotten him. When it all came back to me, this very charismatic sort of young boy, you know, we did this weird moment when we were all in the woods together and I was playing like Captain Hook, because it was like a flashback where the barrister who was trying to shut the school down was all based on a true story about Ofsted. So I think he has done bits and pieces, but his work as a musician and those videos, the music, he's incredible, such a talent.
Tracy-Ann, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for interviewing me.
Well, that sounds incredible, doesn't it? I'm so excited about that one, and I cannot wait. That is coming to Channel 4 at some point later this year. Thank you to Tracy-Ann for joining me on the podcast today. I think a lot of what Paul Chahidi spoke about in last week's episode really connected with you at home, and I think Tracy-Ann continues that conversation so well. Thank you for being so open and honest about the issues we're all facing at the moment. If you enjoyed this podcast, please continue to rate and review us on your pod provider of choice. And please subscribe. We hit the top 100 on Apple Podcasts for TV and film last week, and I greedily have my eyes on the top 50 now. That's it for another episode. I'll be back very, very soon. But in the meantime, please stay indoors.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.